It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday News. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, it's your public radio station. Broadcasting from Kodiak, Alaska, where it is a beautiful 53 degrees. We're looking at sunny skies and hoping for a high near 60 today. Calm winds will turn to the east, go up to 5 miles per hour. Clear skies tonight, low around 44. And partly sunny skies tomorrow with a high near 55. Coming up on the Midday News, Kodiak's historic barn begins its rehabilitation. And a bill that would protect the graves of Alaska Native people forced to live in an internment camp at Funter Bay has passed the legislature. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski said she'll vote in favor of a bill creating a commission to investigate the January 6th assault on the U.S. Capitol. And latest modeling from the U.S. CDC looks good, providing vaccinations keep up. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Silicon Valley is reeling from the latest mass shooting in the United States. A transit employee opened fire on coworkers today at a rail yard in San Jose. Local authorities say the gunman killed 8 people before taking his own life. Multiple people were wounded. NPR's Eric Westerveld has the latest.
Police say the employee began shooting just after 6:30 local time at a light rail maintenance yard for the Valley Transportation Authority, or VTA, in San Jose. VTA employees are among the dead and wounded. San Jose Mayor Sam Liccardo calls it a horrific and tragic day for the city and the transit agency.
And our heart pains for the families and the co-workers, because we know that so many are feeling deeply this loss of their loved ones and their friends.
Mayor Liccardo also says the suspect's house, loaded with ammunition, had been set on fire. Police say the bomb squad was called to the shooting scene amid concerns the shooter might have placed multiple explosive devices inside the VTA building. Eric Westerveld, NPR News.
This is the latest in a series of mass shootings this spring. Gunmen have also taken lives in Atlanta, Boulder, Shreveport, Austin, and Indianapolis. Leading U.S. government scientists are calling for a fuller investigation into the origins of the coronavirus outbreak in China. NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports that includes the possibility the virus came from a lab.
The epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak was the Chinese city of Wuhan. The city is also home to 2 Chinese infectious disease laboratories, and one of those laboratories was doing research on bat coronaviruses. During a Senate hearing today, Republicans repeatedly asked about the possibility that SARS-CoV-2 could have leaked from that lab. Anthony Fauci, the president's chief medical advisor, says he thinks the virus is more likely to have come from a natural source, but
no one knows, including me, 100%. What the origin is the reason why we're in favor of further investigation.
Fauci and other researchers say they would like to see the World Health Organization embark on a more thorough investigation of the virus's origins. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News, Washington.
A decades-long effort to get corporations to take climate change more seriously delivered historic blows to oil giants today. A small hedge fund won enough shareholder backing to elect 2 of its candidates to ExxonMobil's board. And a court in The Hague's ordering Royal Dutch Shell to comply with carbon-reducing commitments in the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. Here's Terry Schultz.
The ruling requires Shell to cut its carbon emissions by 45% of 2019 levels by the year 2030, as contained in the UN climate agreement signed in Paris. The plaintiffs, led by environmental and human rights organizations, said that because the oil giant emits 9 times more CO2 than the entire country of the Netherlands, it must be included in efforts to curb carbon output.
It's NPR.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
At last Friday's meeting of the Historic Preservation Commission, the group took up one item, the Kodiak Agricultural Experiment Station Barn, or more popularly known as the Barn. The barn, first built in 1922 by the federal government as a part of a plan to assess the agricultural potential of Alaska, sits next door to the city library. It was entered into the National Historical Register of the National Register of Historic Places in 2004, and according to a recent condition report, is in urgent need of rehabilitation. With the barn turning 100 years old this next year, making it the second oldest structure in Kodiak Island, that probably comes as no surprise. At the commission's March meeting, Jason Swift, an architect hired to assess the barn, noted the condition of the building is at its tipping point.
Basic structural systems seem to be in really good shape. It seems stable, intact, but you have a roof system that is on the edge of failing. You know, there isn't a lot of large leaks, but you're right on that cusp of where it will, once it does start leaking, it's going to be a very rapid decline. And then on the siding, the same kind of thing where it's partially intact, but the siding has definitely started that rapid decline.
On Friday, the commission finalized a plan with three components, as city engineer Matt Holmstrom explains.
We're going to replace the shingles on a roof with new shingles, and then we're going to replace the exterior paint. And we know that we did a survey on the existing coating, and it's lead-based paint. So when we remove that existing paint, we have to abate the lead. And then once we remove that existing coating, then we will repaint.
The city has budgeted about $150,000 for this project. And while the renovations sound good, there is one more thing to keep in mind, according to Commission Chair Molly O'Dell.
With these upgrades, we're always just keeping in mind keeping the historic character of the barn. So we discussed that at the last meeting. So the shingles wouldn't be much different from what's already there. We're not making any major character changes to the barn, but that's the main thing we're going to want to keep in mind moving forward with upgrades and changes is it going to change the character?
The new roof and new siding, though, is a short-term solution to keep the building from further decline. Depending on how the city decides to ultimately use the barn, will determine any future upgrades. Councilmember Charlie Davidson serves on the commission.
It's a jewel that's been neglected for a long time.
The project is currently out for bid. Work on the barn is expected to begin in August. A bill that will protect the graves of Alaska Native people who were forced to live in an internment camp in Funter Bay passed in the Alaska legislature and is awaiting Governor Mike Dunleavy's signature. KTOO's Lindsay Brolini reports on how the bill got passed and why protecting the graves at Funter Bay is so important.
When the Japanese invaded the Aleutians during World War II, the U.S. government forced Unnanuq people to live in internment camps in southeast Alaska. They had to stay in those camps for 2 years without being provided basic life necessities. About 10% of people died at the Funter Bay internment camp. Most of them were children or elders. House Bill 10 will protect the graves of the Unnanuq people who died in Funter Bay. Representative Sarah Hannon from Juneau sponsored the bill.
This camp in particular, you know, it's just a compounding of errors of history.
The Unnanuq people interned at Funter Bay were one of the first Unnanuq people to come into contact with the Russians. The Russians enslaved them, forced them to relocate to the Pribilof Islands, which were uninhabited at the time, and forced them to hunt seals for their fur. A couple hundred years later, the U.S. also forced Unnanuq people in the Pribilofs to hunt seals for the government.
The men placed in internment in Funter Bay are still forced to return to the islands in the summer to seal for the government and told, if you don't do this, we'll never let you return home.
Not a lot of people know about this history. This bill, in addition to protecting the graves of the Unnanuq people who died in Funter Bay, raises awareness about the internment of Unnanuq people in southeast Alaska. Hannon introduced a bill to protect the Funter Bay Cemetery to last year's legislature. She and her staff, along with Unnanuq elders and the advocacy group Friends of Admiralty Island, worked hard to educate Alaska lawmakers about the Funter Bay internment camps and the lasting effects of the camp on the families. The bill was making headway in the legislature until the pandemic halted most bills. When the bill was reintroduced this year as House Bill 10, it went pretty smoothly. Most legislators already knew about the bill from last year and were supportive. Martin Stepton is an advocate for the bill and a member of the Friends of Admiralty Island.
It went kind of unnaturally fast through the legislature this year, which is really great, you know. We're super proud of that.
Stepton is Unanach, or Aleut, and Tlingit, and his grandparents were interned at Funter Bay. To Stepton, the state recognizing the violent past of the land they own at Funter Bay is a crucial aspect of the bill.
What happened to the Aleuts in 1942 by the federal government was a really bad thing. It was a really bad thing that we don't ever want to happen again. And the only way we can ever protect ourselves from things that happened to us by us is to remember it. That's why we have history class. That's why we have history.
To Stepton and the Friends of Admiralty Island, the work has just started. There are other cemeteries in Southeast Alaska that are not protected, such as the cemetery in Killisnoo on Admiralty Island. Stepton wants to seek protection of this cemetery next. In Juneau, I'm Lindsay Brolini.
Yesterday, U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski said that she'll vote in favor of a Democratic bill creating a commission to investigate the January 6th assault on the Capitol. As Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports, within the state's congressional delegation, Murkowski might stand alone on this.
Murkowski says she hopes a January 6th commission will establish what motivated the mob to storm the Capitol.
And to ensure that we don't see in the future a similar attack on our institution and our democracy.
Murkowski is only the second Republican senator to back the bill, after Mitt Romney of Utah. A few other GOP senators say they like the idea of creating a commission, but want to see changes to its structure or staffing. It would take 10 Senate Republicans to overcome an expected filibuster. Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan says he doesn't yet have a position on the bill.
I'm looking at it right now.
So you haven't decided?
Nope.
The Senate's Republican minority leader, Mitch McConnell, is denouncing the bill. He says Democrats want a commission so they can continue to implicate former President Donald Trump.
I think this is a purely political exercise that adds nothing to the sum total of information.
Murkowski says finding Trump responsible was the point of his second impeachment trial. She was among seven Republicans who voted to convict him of incitement to insurrection. Trump was acquitted. Murkowski says the commission would serve a different purpose.
My hope is that what we will have with an independent commission will be a thoughtful and considered and a not a partisan approach to this. We've done that already.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is pushing for a vote on the bill this week. He says the need for a commission to establish the facts is more important than ever.
In the months since January 6th, Washington Republicans have tried to rewrite history and recast the attack on January 6th as little more than peaceful protests that got out of hand.
The House passed the bill last week with 35 Republican votes. Alaska Congressman Don Young voted against the measure. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The latest modeling from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control shows a steep decline in coronavirus infections in the United States, providing that residents continue to vaccinate and wear masks and practice social distancing where appropriate. The pandemic, as we've experienced it over the past 14 months, could be under control by July. Part of the strategy involves vaccinating as many eligible people as possible, and now that includes children age 12 and up. KCAW's Robert Woolsey recently spoke with the SEARHC Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Elliot Brule, to hear his views on the importance of vaccinating children to end the pandemic.
Even when looking at the exponential decline in the infection rate in the United States that vaccination has helped to bring about, Brule is cautious about forecasting any sort of all clear. Southeast Alaska has unique circumstances that put it outside of traditional modeling.
You know, we have isolated populations of people, and then we have people coming in from the outside, which at times has protected us in the last year and a half, and at other times it's exposed us.
He points to the recent outbreak of infections at a high school wrestling tournament in Ketchikan, which brought cases back to Sitka and Mount Edgecombe High Schools. The key to controlling these bursts of infection among unvaccinated populations is to vaccinate them, an option that has been available for young people aged 12 and up only since May 10th. The alternative is to limit the activities of students, as was done early in the pandemic. Brule sees this as harmful, both medically and socially.
Young people need to participate in these kinds of activities. It's essential to their well-being that they're involved in extracurricular activities. And yet, when you have an outbreak like this, it not only does it affect them, but more importantly, it affects the whole society that we're living in, and it affects our economy. It affects the ability of us to market ourselves as a safe place for visitors. It affects our ability to keep our schools open and our daycares and our businesses. It affects our ability to safely navigate the community without a mask, which of course is important to everybody's sense of well-being and not feeling depressed.
Brule was a practicing physician in Southeast for years before entering hospital management. This is not the first time he's encountered vaccine hesitancy in his practice. While no drug, or any medical procedure for that matter, is without some risk, Brule says the new coronavirus vaccines are built on decades of research and centuries of healthcare practice, and they are the arrows in the quiver that are going to end this pandemic and prevent future ones.
There has never been a medication or a public health intervention that has been more effective at improving the health of human beings than vaccination. And that goes back to the 1790s when we first started vaccinating people for smallpox, and it's true all the way up through the 20th century. And in all of that time, there has never been a vaccine that has been as intensely studied and intensely monitored for safety as this vaccine.
The number of people who need to be vaccinated to end the pandemic is a bit of a moving target. Brule says it is around 70%. Sitka has already topped that goal in its adult population, which is why the emphasis is now shifting to kids. The overall approach needs to be a little less hand-wringing about the statistics, he says, and a little more determination around simply moving forward with our vaccination efforts. And that is what will ultimately put the pandemic behind us, whether it's this July or beyond.
So what the end game looks like is that we manage to vaccinate a substantial enough portion of the population that epidemic spread no longer becomes realistic.
And lastly, there's the idea that every parent understands that we won't feel safe until our children are safe. There are a lot of good reasons to vaccinate our kids, says Brule, not the least of which is that we love them and want them to stay healthy. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Wildfire season has begun in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. A large fire near Keokuk and a smaller one near Scammon Bay began in the last few days. KYUK's Greg Kim has this report.
The fire still burning near Keokuk is large, around 100 acres, according to State Division of Forestry spokesperson Tim Mowry. The fire is located about 2 miles south of Keokuk on the opposite side of the Kuskokwim River as a village. No injuries or deaths have been reported as a result of the fire. Keokuk Police Chief Ann Charles said that 4 or 5 houses at fish camps have burned down. Charles and several tribal police officers were the first to respond to the fire last night and were there until around 5 a.m. this morning. At that point, she said the fire was small enough to fight with 5-gallon buckets of water from the river and by stomping on it.
We contained some of it, and this morning I got another call saying that it started up again.
The fire grew to 200 acres. This afternoon, the Division of Forestry dispatched a dozen smoke jumpers from Fairbanks to the fire near Accuchuck. Division spokesperson Mowry said they are focused on preventing any further fish camps from being destroyed. Mowry also said initial reports indicate that a discarded lit cigarette may have started the fire. The wildfire near Scammon Bay is much smaller than the one near Accuchuck and is also not threatening the village. Mowry said there are no injuries or deaths reported, but some fish camps may be threatened. He said that thermal imaging satellites detected a fire 6 to 7 miles southwest of Scammon Bay yesterday. He said as of today, the fire was only 2 acres and was headed west towards the coast. The state has not deployed any firefighters to the fire near Scammon Bay, primarily because smoke jumpers are occupied with other fires. In Bethel, I'm Greg Kim.
Today's KMXT local news is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way, 486-4782.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Bacon-flavored seaweed is a new hit for foodies. More after this.
Did you know that eating wild and sustainable Alaska seafood can boost your immune system? Learn more about Alaska seafood's many proven nutritional benefits at wildalaskaseafood.com.
A type of seaweed that naturally tastes like bacon is quickly becoming the new it superfood. Dulse is a red seaweed that can be found along the coasts from California to Alaska. It's been used as a food source for centuries throughout Scotland, Ireland, and Scandinavia, but is now being rediscovered at Oregon State University's Hatfield Marine Science Center in Newport.
We thought that the most valuable crop from our dulse abalone co-culture system would be the abalone.
Chris Langdon is a professor of fisheries at OSU. He says they've discovered that the red seaweed is the more valuable of the two.
It's so expensive. When you buy dulse, it can be anywhere from $30 to $90 a pound dry weight.
The pricey seaweed is so packed with protein and other nutrients, researchers are finding that it tops another leafy green superfood, kale.
It's much more nutritious than kale, for sure. I mean, it has quite a lot of protein. It has a lot of really good trace metals and minerals, a lot of iodine and antioxidants such as polyphenols and vitamin C. And it also has these marine oils.
A chef at the Food Innovation Center in Portland found that adding a little oil in a frying pan brought out the flavor in the seaweed, putting dulse in the global spotlight.
We thought we were onto something completely new, but when we started reading reports and cooking books, we found that others actually had reported that dulse can taste like bacon when you fry it.
Researchers and chefs have been testing dulse in a variety of different food products, from ice cream to salad dressings, even beer.
The interest that we've received from all over the world indicates that this is something quite important. There are a lot of people who can't eat meat or they can't eat pork. So the potential of being able to eat something that tastes like bacon is very appealing to those folks.
Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods, serving Alaska's fishing communities since 1910. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Wednesday. It is the 26th day of May, the year 2021. The sun rose today at 5:27 and it will set again at 10:49, giving us 17 hours and 23 minutes of daylight, a gain of 3 minutes and 17 seconds compared to yesterday. Looking at our local tides, we have an incoming tide. Our high tide will be at 3:10 p.m. and be 7.6 feet here on the east side. The next low tide will be at 8:27 p.m. and be 1.5 feet. Your high tide for the middle of the night will be at 2:39 a.m. and be 10.8 feet. And your low tide for tomorrow morning on the east side, another significant minus tide, fun tide pooling, at 9:30 a.m. is going to be a minus 2.7 foot tide. Real big minus tide. Over on the west side, and these are Uganic Pass tides, your next high tide will be at 3:29 p.m. and be 15.7 feet.
followed by a low tide at 9:17 p.m. of 0.5 feet. Your next high tide will be at 3:11 a.m. and be 17.7 feet, followed by a low tide tomorrow morning on the west side at 9:54 a.m. of minus 4.7 feet. 53 degrees right now here in Kodiak. It is a beautiful day. Sunny skies for the rest of the day, partly sunny skies tomorrow, and mostly clear skies overnight. We're looking for a high of 60 today. Don't know if we're going to get that. For tomorrow, we're looking for a high of 55. Calm winds until then. Thursday night, mostly cloudy skies with a low around 44 and southeast winds to 5. And for Friday, we're looking for a 30% chance of rain after 4 p.m. Saturday, they are calling for rain, high near 52. Chance of precipitation on Saturday is 90%. Good time to go to the art show inside in Fisherman's Hall. Mariners, here's your synopsis for the North Gulf Coast, including Kodiak Island waters and Cook Inlet. A high pressure will remain across the Gulf today. A weak front will move near Kodiak Island Thursday morning and track into the eastern Gulf by Friday morning. We do have small craft advisories on both sides of the island. For our east side offshore, Marmot Island to Sitkanak, southwest 25 right now, seas to 7 feet. For tomorrow, south wind to 15 knots, seas to 5 feet. Over in the Shelikof on Kodiak's west side, small craft advisory through tonight as well. Southwest 30 in the Shelikof right now, seas to 10 feet. Those winds should diminish to 20 knots late tonight. And for tomorrow in the Shelikof, look for southwest 15, becoming variable less than 10. Seas 4 feet, subsiding to 2 feet tomorrow afternoon in the Shelikof. For inside waters, Chiniak and Marmot Bays. Chiniak Bay, northwest 10, becoming variable less than 10 this afternoon, seas to 2 feet. For tomorrow, variable less than 10, becoming southeast 10 tomorrow afternoon, seas to 2 feet. Up at Marmot Bay, west wind to 20 knots right now and seas to 4 feet. For tomorrow, variable less than 10, becoming east 10 tomorrow afternoon, seas to 2 feet in Marmot Bay. The Kodiak City Council will be having a regular meeting on Thursday. That's happening at 7:30 p.m. in the Kodiak Public Library Multipurpose Room. The meeting is open to the public. Will be broadcast right here on KMXT on 100.1 FM and web streamed from the city's website, where you can also find the meeting agenda, meeting packets, and the link to get the web streaming. For more information, call the city clerk at 486-8636. The Assembly is having a work session on Thursday as well. That's happening at 6:30 p.m. at the Bayside Volunteer Fire Station. Other meetings going on in the borough. Next Tuesday, the Women's Bay Service Area is having their regular board meeting. That's happening Tuesday, 5:30 p.m. in the Women's Bay Fire Hall. Next Thursday, June 3rd, the Local Emergency Planning Committee is having their quarterly meeting. That's happening at 11 a.m. in the Assembly of Chambers next Thursday, June 3rd. AMC and Alaska Sea Grant are conducting a fishing vessel drill conductor class in Kodiak starting tomorrow. That's going 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. tomorrow and the next day from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Friday. That's happening at the UFA Seafood and Marine Science Center. The cost for class is $125 for commercial fishermen, $175 for others. This class meets the U.S. Coast Guard training requirements for drill conductors on commercial fishing vessels. It's easy to register online at www.amsea.org, that's AMSEA.org, or you can call them at 907-747-3287. In addition to these classes here in Kodiak, they will be having the identical classes in Naknek June 10th and 11th, and in Dillingham June 12th and 13th. And again, you want to register for all those classes at www.amc.org. The Crab Festival book sale is back. The Kodiak Public Library Association will hold the book sale at the KPL Multipurpose Room Friday and Saturday. On Friday morning between 10 and 11 a.m., members only, please, but the public is welcome Friday between 11 a.m. from 4 p.m. and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Fill a KPLA bag and enjoy. For more information,
contact Roberta at 486-6189.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT two times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.